Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. And we have another law nerd show for you today, talking about the case West Virginia EPA, which is just another one of the cases where the Supreme Court is dismantling our democracy and the country that we grew up with and know and love. Joining me to talk about why the Supreme Court is an awful institution and we should deserve it no respect is Matt Simmons, staff attorney with EPIC. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom. Happy to be here.
And EPIC legal intern, Rosalind Cuneo. Hey, Rosalind.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
We also have Scott Greeson.
I'm the conservation director.
Conservation director. Wonderful. So we're talking about West Virginia v. EPA. Does anybody here want to break down the background to this case? What are we talking about here in this decision?
I can try. Under the Clean Air Act, the EPA has the responsibility to regulate stationary sources, which are big emitting things like power plants. Under the Obama administration, the Obama EPA created a rule called the Clean Power Plan that would regulate coal power plants in order to make them less emitting. It did this in three ways. It did it sort of the traditional way, which was like putting some sort of technology into the coal power plant that made it slightly less emissions causing. But then it also encouraged coal power plants to switch to either natural gas or to renewable energy. And by encouraged, I mean required. That was sort of the novel idea of this plan. There isn't a way to make a coal power plant reduce emissions enough to actually tackle climate change. And so at some point, these plants are going to have to switch over. And the Obama EPA tried to require that slowly, not all at once. And it was very thought out and careful, but it did require some switching. That rule was challenged immediately by fossil fuel companies and like half of the states, all the right-leaning states. Yeah, Scott.
Just to point out that when we say half of the right-leaning states, what we actually mean is that this lawsuit was conceived and brought to fruition by the Republican Attorneys General's Association, which is a litigating arm of the political party, ironically born out of the efforts of Democratic attorneys generals to go after the tobacco industry. The Republicans saw that and were like, cool, that's an idea we can steal. So this is not the state's political project.
Definitely. So they successfully stop Obama's rule from being implemented. That rule was written at the very end of the Obama administration. So then, of course, Donald Trump is elected. The Trump administration rescinds the Obama rule because it was too mean to coal, basically, and writes their own rule that's very nice to coal. But this litigation somehow zombie keeps going in a way that I still don't entirely understand, because to me, that right there should have been the end of this whole thing. Of course, Donald Trump then loses his election to Joe Biden. Joe Biden has not written a new rule or reenacted the Obama rule. He's still writing his rule. But now we have this court case that comes up that is about a rule that was rescinded 4 years ago. Yeah, Scott.
Well, and the case purports to turn on this question of how the EPA is exercising the power delegated to it by Congress to address air pollution. In the meantime, the Trump plan that you referred to, Matt, has been overturned by the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals because it flatly goes against the plain meaning of the Clean Air Act. None of this explains how the Supreme Court reaches out and takes this case, which if Enviros did this, we'd be laughed off the continent.
Yeah, it's definitely two different rule books for the two sides of this issue. Yeah, Tom.
One of the other interesting things about the kind of procedural background of this case is that the target set by the Obama administration were met. We blew past those targets. We've reduced the amount of coal energy that's being produced. And that just came from natural market forces. Natural gas was cheaper than coal. Renewable energy was cheaper than coal. Coal energy is kind of expensive to produce because it's just this like antiquated way. We're burning rocks to extract the heat from those rocks and to turn generators. We've figured out kind of more cost-effective ways of doing this that also in turn produce fewer greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, especially when you account for the pollution that burning those rocks creates. Yeah.
So all this is to say, and Justice Kagan in her dissenting opinion would agree with me that we have just like a really weird case here, because there's a law that never took effect, that never was intending to take effect, that is now being weighed upon by the Supreme Court. And so we have something in the law called an advisory opinion, which the Supreme Court is supposed to avoid. The Supreme Court is only supposed to decide actual cases and controversies. But here they were like, nah, we're going to weigh in. We're going to opine on the constitutionality of this law that never took effect, that is never going to take effect, because we want to take a swing at the modern administrative state. I think that functionally, that's what this case represents. Rosalind, would you like to try to take a swing at what John Roberts is trying to do in the majority opinion, if there's like any seed of rationality to his thought?
Yeah. So the thing about this and other Roberts opinion is that he takes such a rational, reasonable tone. He's trying to assure you, oh, this won't hurt a bit. What he does is he looks into other decisions and he pulls out this thing that he calls the major questions doctrine, which is new. And as Kagan writes in the dissent, he uses it as a get out of text free card, because the text of the statute under its section 111 is very clear that the EPA has the authority to regulate any airborne pollutant that might harm public health or welfare or cause environmental problems. And it's so clear that carbon dioxide falls under that authority. And he says that the statute gives the EPA broad authority, and it's written like that so that the agency can react to new scientific information as it comes up. And Roberts says that there's a caveat there, that they can't do anything that's too big, that's too new, unless it was clearly and explicitly authorized by Congress. So even if Congress says choose the best system of emissions reduction, essentially the court thinks that the system that they chose is too new, the court has a veto.
So Rosalind, how do we know when it's too new? What's the standard?
When it gives the conservative Supreme Court the heebie-jeebies.
I think they don't like it.
But the other thing he says is that a major question is something that raises significant political and economic impact, or at least the possibility of that. And the problem being, of course, that as Tom just told us, the 2018 Clean Power Plan that they're supposedly deciding on didn't have any impact. Well, market forces completely overwhelmed the policy.
It is an entirely subjective test. What is a major question? When is something so fundamental, so changing of our society that the major questions doctrine gets invoked? I don't think that there can be a rational explanation or an objective explanation of when the doctrine, newly discovered in the 1990s, will come into play.
But it's not says, like, the conservatives know it when they see it. That's what they're saying. And that's the real danger here. It's not the thinly sliced salami that Roberts is offering us up here in terms of his ruling about what EPA can and cannot possibly regulate if Congress tells them they can. What's really on offer here is a court that is unbound, that doesn't pay attention to precedent, that doesn't pay attention to law, really, or even intellectual rigor in the normal sense. And I think it's important for us to think about the West Virginia versus EPA case in the context of the last few weeks of actions from the court. We've had a series of sweeping rulings from an aggressively activist right-wing court that are all based substantially on lies. The Dobbs ruling on abortion, the Bruin ruling on the Second Amendment, and perhaps none more egregious than the school prayer case, Kennedy versus Bremerton Schools. So the dissent puts a picture in of what's actually happening to say to the majority, you're just lying here and everybody can see it. What all this should tell us is that intellectual consistency is a mug's game. The right cares about power and its use. It's used to reward and protect its friends and to punish and suppress its enemies. Wilhoit's law is really instructive here. And this is the idea that conservatism consists of exactly one proposition, there must be in-groups whom the law protects but does not bind, alongside out-groups who the law binds but does not protect. And you think about that, it is the exact inverse of the idea of equality, a political equality of everyone having an equal stake in this society politically. And we're in a very, very bad place. And as Frederick Douglass told us in 1857, power concedes nothing without a demand. And we are going to have to go around, we're going to have to go over, and we're going to have to go through this court. But there is nothing good that will come out of it from here on out. Nothing at all.
Let's get into the idea of what do we do about the Supreme Court and how do we move forward in the face of just bad decision after bad decision, not just West Virginia v. EPA.
But bad faith.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, a weaponized Supreme Court, it is unelected political actors hiding their partisanship behind robes and like some formality to like try to create some sort of a guise of objectivity and like neutrality that doesn't exist. But before there, I want to just finish off on the major questions doctrine. So we have this idea that regulations can't occur on topics that are of substance and of importance to our economy and to our society unless Congress has directly spoken and given permission for an administrative agency to do this. So I just want to highlight that this is not just about the EPA and whether the EPA can force coal power plants to become gas power plants instead. This is about the entire administrative state. So like one civics lessons back, right, is that like Congress passes laws, those laws are often broadly written, and then it is turned over to the administrative agencies like the EPA or the FDA or the SEC to create regulations to implement this like broad structure that Congress passes. And that's what's happened here in West Virginia v. EPA. But it happens all across everything, from clean water to regulating drugs, to regulating monopolies. This is something that is standard in our form of government, our democratic form of government. The major questions doctrine now allows for not just the Supreme Court, but activist judges across the entire federal judiciary to just invalidate wholesale regulations that have been potentially on the books for many years that they believe invoke some sort of a major question and where Congress hasn't clearly stated. In law school, we learn about this era of supremely bad Supreme Court decisions, the Lochner era of the early 20th century, running up into the New Deal, where the court employed, among other tools, something called the non-delegation doctrine that said that Congress can't delegate rulemaking authority to an administrative agency. That same doctrine that we all learned in law school was just utterly ridiculous, made up by the Supreme Court to cripple the New Deal, amongst other things. This is that same doctrine, but just rosied up a bit. It has some makeup on to try to disguise it, but it is fundamentally the same idea under new language invented by the conservatives on the Supreme Court in the 1990s. Matt, and then Rosalind.
Someone who isn't familiar with all of this might be saying or thinking to themselves, like, but what happens when an agency goes too far? What should we do when there is some sort of agency that runs amok? That's why we have our courts to check them in. But in a case like this, where you're looking at a broadly written statute that delegates a lot of authority to an agency, who is the better political actor to decide if the agency isn't doing what Congress wants them to do? 9 unelected Supreme Court justices or Congress? It's just shocking here that in this case, 6 Supreme Court justices have effectively legislated to make the Clean Air Act say something new because they don't like what it says. They claim that what they're doing is protecting Congress and protecting Congress from over-delegating its authority. But what they're actually doing is taking the clear language of Congress that says, we want the EPA to create a system for reducing emissions from these power plants, and saying, no, they can't do it like that because it raises an eyebrow. It feels too new or too big or too different. What we would have in a functioning democracy is a situation where Congress would step in and act if it felt any agency had overstepped its authority. That would be like the normal functioning thing to do. But because our Congress hasn't been functioning for the last 40 years, no one seriously believes that that's possible. And so all these fights happen in the courts through litigation. And we end up with a cabal of robed policymakers who decide what our country has and can do. It's just such a dark, upsetting future that we're headed towards, because they're going to keep making policy decisions like this on every single kind of thing that matters to us all. Yeah, upsetting.
The Eco News Report, we're talking about the supremely bad Supreme Court decision in West Virginia v. Dobbs and the future of climate change regulation.
Yeah, it's really upsetting. And I think to Matt's point, it's interesting to see headlines on this case that are all the Supreme Court has hindered Biden's climate change policies. It makes it really easy to ignore because we love ignoring climate change in this country. And everyone just sees another headline that says, oh, well, here's an environmental loss. And they think, yeah, we just throw that on the pile. But it gives these 9 unelected judges a veto over Congress. And then this, as they delegate to the agencies or they write these broad statutes, the interpretation is so obviously contrary to what was in the statute. The Kagan dissent's fun to read because she's effectively saying, can the majority read? I'm not sure if they can read this statute. But the scary thing is, well, clearly they can. They know what they're doing. It's not an honest interpretation of the statute.
All right. So let's move next to how do we respond and continue to move forward with regulating greenhouse gas emissions after West Virginia v. EPA, and then what the heck do we do about the Supreme Court to close today's conversation?
We don't have an answer to those things. What we have to do is be realistic about the threat we're facing. And I'm braced by the candor that the rest of you are bringing to this conversation today, because that's what I think we need collectively, is some realism. And the reality we're facing is that this Supreme Court, if it continues on its path, is probably going to eliminate the EPA if the Republican Party doesn't do it on its own. They certainly want to. Let's think less about what procedural tools we might use, how we can reinterpret the word system so that it works, and more about power, as I said, and the fact that we're going to have to find ways to overcome the power of an aggressive, radical court and courts. And that is going to require a substantial rethinking of not just the environmental movement, but a lot of the movements for liberation and justice in our country. We have relied to a great extent on the courts from the middle of the 20th century on, because we had the post-New Deal courts to work with. That was an aberration in American history. And what we have to realize is that we're standing very much in a similar place to that Frederick Douglass was in when he wrote before the Civil War. Power concedes nothing without a demand, and we're going to have to get into a real struggle. I hope that doesn't mean armed struggle, but they leave us very little choice in terms of how to reform agencies and move forward if they continue to break all of the instruments of self-governance.
I'm going to get back to answering my question that I originally posed, because you wanted to get to the fun one, the larger structural reform thing too quickly, Scott. And I feel like I need to answer the what can we still do, right? So the Supreme Court decision, it doesn't easily apply to the states. We have this major questions doctrine. It seems limited to federal administrative agencies and Congress's relationship with those. So if California, let's say, wanted to continue to move forward on regulating stationary sources of greenhouse gas emissions within the power granted to it by the Clean Air Act, by Congress, we as a state of California can continue to do that. So here's hoping that the California Air Resources Board comes up with a better final version of its scoping plan, which you can listen to in a previous episode of the Eco News Report. And then let's think about if the Biden administration were to want to try to regulate greenhouse gas emissions in the post-West Virginia v. EPA kind of world. Fundamentally, what the Supreme Court has said is that the thing that makes the most sense, the thing that is the cheapest for us to accomplish, which would be power switches, like just replacing coal power with renewable energy, that is the most effective, that is the cheapest. That's fundamentally off the table for the EPA to mandate. What the EPA still can do theoretically after West Virginia v. EPA is actually kind of the dumber solution, which is we could implement something like carbon capture and storage, where we just burn coal and then pipe it underground into old salt caverns and try to store it in perpetuity, which is not only dumb, because that is incredibly risky and we have no good long-term proof of concept there, but it's also way more expensive. And so fundamentally, what they're saying is, you can't do the easy thing. We're going to force you to do the dumb thing here, EPA. So that's kind of like what's left in this world for the EPA, is like outrageous, unproven stuff like carbon capture and storage, unless Congress speaks and gives the EPA greater power to do something. So let's get now to the conversation of like, what do we do, right? So like, we have a Supreme Court which is finding new rights that are previously unrecognized throughout our country's existence. So we have this Supreme Court, which then also, on the other hand, is finding that rights that we have long held and cherished, like the right to privacy, which undergirds the right to choose, reproductive rights, may be gone. And with the right to privacy, the right to interracial marriage, the right to contraception, the right for gay marriage, all might also go out the window, as Thomas excitedly, gleefully highlights in his dissent in the Dobbs case. So like, we need to do something about the Supreme Court. We need to do something about our democracy here while we still got it. Matt, do you have any solutions? Because I don't know, man. I don't have some great answers at this point.
Yeah, it's not an easy problem to solve. On the court specifically, one of the solutions that I've heard bandied about is something called jurisdiction stripping. Congress would pass a law saying that the court can't rule on a particular issue. There's precedent for this. Congress passed a law saying the Supreme Court couldn't rule on habeas petitions for Guantanamo Bay prisoners because they didn't like the idea of Guantanamo Bay prisoners having their day in court. And so the Supreme Court didn't hear some of those cases because they were kept out of the court that way. And so you could theoretically pass a law that says, name a right that still exists today that you want to protect, right? Like, the Supreme Court can't hear a case on gay marriage anymore. Whatever comes up to be challenged, they're just not allowed to hear it anymore. I have always found that solution to be a little bit, I don't know, it's sort of crass, right? It's like sort of like taking a sledgehammer to a problem that you'd rather fix with like a tiny little fix. It also envisions a Congress that is willing to do that, which is a whole other problem, right? Like, how the Senate works and apportions two senators to Wyoming and California, even though they have insanely different populations. That solution is maybe possible for the most popular of these rights that the conservative court is likely to take away, but not for everything. Another solution that's been bandied about is court packing. I think everyone has seen like a meme about how FDR threatened to pack the courts and in so doing managed to convince the conservative court at the time to, some of them retired, some of them switched their votes, and eventually the court started acting like a lot of things that they had been saying were unconstitutional suddenly were constitutional. Court packing, I find very interesting, actually, because it has a delegitimizing factor to it, right? Because people will say, oh, if the Democrats court pack, what's to stop the Republicans from court packing? And I'm like, yeah, let's do it. Let's pack the court till there's like 1,000 people on it. And we can all agree that this whole idea of having this third branch of government that has policy responsibilities like this is insane. So that's sort of a nuclear option. Again, requires you to control Congress, requires a president who's willing to take a bigger step than I think our current president is. So I'm sorry, all my solutions are sort of things that are hard to actually do.
Well, I mean, it speaks in part, I think that there are a couple of themes that you bring up. The solution to this is ultimately political. If the court is a political animal and it is governable in some sense through our political institutions, through Congress, through appointments by the presidency, if we win more elections as folks who are left-leaning or environmentalist or whatever we want to call ourselves, right? We just need to win more elections.
No,
we do. Like, oh, fundamentally, oh. Scott, how do we do this without winning more elections? Like,
the point is that become the better. That is not sufficient because the barriers to popular control are so great in this country. And it's not just the malapportionment of political power that Matt just pointed to. It is also that this Supreme Court is approving extreme gerrymandering and is about to approve the state legislative, whatever it is, doctrine that will allow state legislators to appoint whoever they want.
This is the independent state legislator.
Independent theory. State legislator doctrine. Yeah. The point is that voting alone will not do it. So I would respectfully suggest that our job at this point as environmentalists is to stop sucking up to the Supreme Court and start calling them what they are, which is illegitimate and a threat to our survival as people and as a planet. And that's the problem. And it is truly dire, and it is not okay at this point to say, well, we got to preserve our institutions. We do not have to preserve our institutions. We have to preserve what's important here, which is life, which is people, our kids, our grandkids, our future, the air, not even the EPA. So I would respectfully suggest that we blow up the Supreme Court in every non-literal
way.
In every non-literal way possible. Exactly, yeah.
And service, leave us alone.
Exclude its gravitas, mock it, delegitimize it, and as much as possible, ignore it and make it look like a bunch of fools. And like, I know that that is slim hope and almost a mockery of justice when the Supreme Court has just decided that half the people in this country lack the rights that the other half have. But we have to really move on this. And one of the things we're going to need to do is show the court that we don't believe what it wants us to believe, and we're not gonna.
And so the idea there being that we can reform the court by delegitimizing it, and so then they have to moderate themselves in their future opinions to have the power, because the court can't wield normal power.
Build political will to make a change.
Yeah.
That's part of the problem here.
Yeah, that's part of the problem in a constitutional structure that makes it very difficult.
Let's be real clear. Like, the problem here is not the constitutional structure. The problem here is white supremacy. The problem here is corporate patriarchy. It's a bunch of problems of power and money that have been baked into this country from the beginning that continue to recrudesce in various forms. And we got to keep struggling with it. We really don't have a choice. But like, they have seized the heights of the institutions, and I don't think we can any longer afford the luxury of continuing to pretend that the mid-20th century is going to come back. You guys are all too young to believe that anyway, but obviously our political leadership's got a real problem there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we had 2 decades of the Warren Court, which led liberals to believe that we could achieve good things through the Supreme Court, whereas we ignore the entire other history of the Supreme Court as a conservative reactionary force that stands in the way of social progress. So I agree in part. I like to delegitimize the Supreme Court. I think that we should make fun of them. We should even do things as small as have public airings, have cameras in the Supreme Court to get these demigods off of their Mount Olympus. We need to bring them back down to what they really are, which are unelected politicians in robes pretending that they can
communicate with the dead and understand what the people who passed the Clean Air Act in the 70s really would have wanted, right?
Yeah, like, or imagining that they are on some plane with the founding fathers and they like understand what the Constitution truly means. I'm okay with that. I think that we also, though, need to take a page from the conservative political institution and look at what they did after Roe v. Wade. The entirety of the conservative judicial project of the last 40 years was building to this moment. And that is achieving supremacy on the Supreme Court by having better numbers. We need to do the same. And I think that requires us winning elections. There are certainly barriers to us winning elections. Like, those are built into the Constitution. I think that we just need to have better politics that are more resonant with a majority of voters. Rosalind.
This also shows the need for more local environmental movements as well, because bringing the environmental movement to local levels lets people see the issues and how they affect them directly. When I talk to people, very conservative, politically conservative people in Alaska who told me that climate change was a hoax and was made up and was just invented by coastal elites to tell them what to do. But if you said, well, are there any environmental issues you're concerned about? They go, well, ocean acidification. It's the same thing. It's the same thing, but it's not as political. They can see how it directly affects them and how it affects salmon fisheries and how it affects crab fisheries. And so bringing these movements that these environmental movements that are more inclusive, that are more a bigger tent and more local can also help us make more noise on these environmental issues.
This has been another episode of the Eco News Report. Join us again next week on this time and channel for more environmental news from the North Coast of California.